let me begin by expressing my personal gratitude to Dean Kwashiga for the privilege it has been for me and others at our center to work with him and his staff in organizing this event. As has been mentioned, this is really a dream that goes back three years, and it's wonderful to see this long-cultivated dream coming to fruition. I want also to thank members of the Conference Steering Committee. As you'll see, I'll introduce them a little later in my remarks. I will also, I think we're all conscious we're running a little behind. I do have some things I'd like to say, but I'll try to follow Dean Kwashiga's example in cutting a number of things out of my remarks. During the photo op, I had a chance to talk with Bishop Wamba, and he pointed out that there is evolutionary evidence that we are all Africans. And I often speak talking about the fact that we are all minorities, so I feel sort of honored to be inducted into the class of Africans. And I think I say that in a deeper sense. I think we live in a time when in other parts of the world we are suffering different kinds of secularization, internal secularization, and many of us look to and learn from Africa. I know people from my own tradition, when they come here, they are just moved by the spirituality of African people. So I think there's a hope that that we can share that kind of sense together. At the outset of the conference, I just want to say a few words about building the field of law and religion. You could, if you think about it, there's, in a certain sense, a tension between the remarks of the bishop and the remarks of Dean Kwashiga, although I think they really fit together. On the one hand, there's a sense in which law and religion belong together. In another sense, there are ways that they need to be kept apart. And the puzzle is how to do both of those things right. And I think the field of law and religion has been about that. In one sense, the field of law and religion has been with us as long as law has existed as a discipline. In some ways, in its earliest forms, law was difficult to distinguish from religion, and the two had tight interactions, often to the point of identity. What I want to speak about, though, is sort of the more recent phenomenon, really as I've experienced it in my lifetime. I started teaching about a little over 35 years ago, and at that time, in American law, in American academia, the law and religion section of the American Association of Law Schools had just been founded. Harold Berman had just written his book on the interaction of law and religion. And this was, I have to say, a very interesting field for a few of us. It was a small section. It was, in some ways, a very quiet area. And I experienced a lot of the growth of this section because during the 80s I was either the secretary or the chair of that section for many years. But then things really began to change with the collapse of communism, which triggered transformations of legal systems across, well, from Central Europe to Eastern Siberia. Some kind of chaser, I'm not sure what I'm doing wrong. And it was not just the transformation of Eastern Europe that followed, because at about the same time we had the end of apartheid in South Africa, the revision of a lot of secular regimes, notably Mexico, which had been perhaps as secular as Russia from 1917 to about 1993. The end of the east-west polarization brought with it changes in many regimes. And so with those changes came transformations in the way people were thinking about law and religion. The euphoria that came with the 1990s, however, has gradually given way to retrenchment and to greater restrictions on religious freedom. Part of this is the result of a variety of concerns with religious extremism and pressures for security after September 11th in 2001. More generally, we're witnessing a process in which religious freedom is suffering setbacks, not so much as a result of direct attacks on the idea of religious freedom, but as the result of a steady process of erosion by exception. The notion that ordinary laws can override religious freedom claims has expanded, even where courts continue to balance religious claims against other state interests. The range of interests that can override religious liberty claims is constantly expanded, and there's much more that can be said about that. But one of the things that's happening globally is that while we live, really 2 centuries into the era in which people began to recognize that religious freedom and separation of religion in some form from the state is good for society. The research, latest research done by Pew, their 2009 report indicated that 32% of the countries on Earth have high or very high restrictions on religious freedom. And since some of the largest countries on Earth are in those categories, in their first study, 70% of the global population lives in countries with high or very high restrictions on religious freedom. And significantly, their most recent studies show that this is getting worse. It's now about 75%. Now, of course, some of the constraints on freedom of religion are justified. We need to acknowledge what Scott Appleby has called the ambivalence of the sacred. There are, of course, bad things that religion has done, as well as the high and ennobling things that it contributes to society. But I fear we live in an age in which we are beginning to forget the values that have made our age, including much that is best about our age, possible. In this regard, I'm reminded of a paradox articulated by the great German thinker Ernst Wolfgang Schopenhauer. He said, "A free, liberal, and democratic state can only be built and sustainable on a foundation that in itself it is unable to create." Part of the reason for that is states depend on a sense of community, meaning, other aspects of human life that have many other factors, but religion is one of the most significant of those. In many countries, we have lived so long with the benefits of religion and religious freedom that we forget their positive values when their negative problems arise. Now, the irony is that it is now more clear than ever before that reducing restrictions on religion, that is, increasing religious freedom, is positively correlated with countless other social goods. Many of you have seen a chart done by the Pew Forum for Religion and Public Life that just shows that there are correlations with countless other social goods, and a nation's adhering to religious freedom. Again, this is something I'll skip over, and I think it's something familiar to this group. One of the really interesting new pieces of work is that there's evidence that suggests that that government intervention and restriction, far from being a method of stabilizing societies, can often do just the opposite, can be counterproductive. Now, this basic insight goes back to Locke, the early liberal thinkers, but we have increasing evidence from the best social science that these are realities and they should affect public policy. believes, of course, that religious freedom is good for society since it helps to unlock the social capital associated with religion itself. And again, I think I won't take time with this group because I think some of this data is well known, it's complex, but it's one of the reasons so many of us care about the relationship of law and religion. It's changing the way people think of development. It used to be that people thought of development primarily as a secular enterprise, but development without taking into account the spiritual dimension of human beings cannot really be optimal. Well, all of these things then have had profound significance for the field of law and religion, and one of the results is that what was a kind of quiet little backwater in academia when I started out has become a forefront area in many disciplines. Law and religion stands sort of at a crossroads between law, political science, theology, sociology, a wide array of disciplines are now being energized and feeling the dynamism of this area. And I can tell you, as the president of the International Consortium for Law and Religion Studies, which is a global organization dealing with this field, there is tremendous interest, and I think many of us really want to learn about what's going on in Africa, and it's not easy because more needs to be done. I'm conscious that we have regional organizations in a number of other parts of the world. Mark Hill is here, he's the current president of the European Consortium of Church State Research. There's a Latin American consortium that deals with these issues. There's a group of people in Russia, Ukraine, and former Soviet space trying to form an organization there. And as those of us on the steering committee met last night, we couldn't help thinking that the time is really ripe for creating a similar kind of consortium in Africa, and this conference could be the occasion for doing that. Obviously, it's not for those of us who, although we can claim some African heritage, it's probably not for us to really create this kind of organization. But if those of you who are here would share the judgment that this is something that could be done, I hope you'll speak with the steering committee about that. And at this point, let me just, so you know who they are, let me just introduce the members of the steering committee. Of course, Dean Kwashiga, whom you've just heard, and myself. But in addition, Rosalind Hackett, you can stand up, and Johan van der Vever, also Professor Peter Kurtzen. Let's see if I've got everyone. Magnus Kielander from the Center for Human Rights in Pretoria has been on this committee, but he was not able to attend the conference. If you agree with us that this is the kind of area that's become increasingly vital, we hope you'll speak with us. We're planning to try to split up with lunches and dinners today and tomorrow. We'll have a closing session in which we can think more carefully about this. We have some ideas for setting up a kind of a listserv or other kind of internet connectivity. If some of you are interested in serving as moderators for that kind of project, that would be helpful to know. We have issues in terms of how to plan publications for this conference and for the future. We have ideas for continuing conferences like this into the future. It's very critical for us to know, to learn from you what other people in this field are so that we can identify that. Let me just conclude by picking up on one other general theme. A couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to, with Javier Martinez Terón from Spain to put together a study of, on religion in the secular state for the International Academy of Comparative Law. One of the things that was really striking, and I think one of the things that I hope we can learn more about as we talk about different systems and talk review and listen to papers in this conference, is a tension between two approaches to the secular state. One you could call secularism, where the secular becomes a kind of end in itself, and in which secularism ends up really almost being hostile to religion. And there's another version, a colleague and I refer to this as secularity. The popes of the past few popes have referred to it as healthy secularity. They're various, it's hard to know what the appropriate term should be, but the difference is one way of looking at the secular is that it becomes an end in itself. Religion is excluded or driven back into the private sphere alone. Another approach is having a framework that can accommodate the differences of religious people in society. In some ways, these differences are associated with colonial history. The French laïcité tends to be a little more inclined toward the secularism as an end in itself. The sort of secular regimes that we see in many parts of the former British, the British Commonwealth and common law world tend to be more accommodating, but it's really a mixed picture. And I think one of the major things going on right now is trying to figure out, as we move into the 21st century, how we strike, which of these kinds of models we choose, or how we structure the place that religions are going to fit in to societies. In older history, there were countries, the old cuius regio model that Dean Boschke talked about, depends on an image of society in which a religion is dominant. In the current world, no society on earth is really like that. There are obviously prevailing religions and obviously majority religions, but no place is a country totally homogeneous. There's too much pluralism in the world we live in. And one of the challenges in a world in which we're all really minorities, if you look beyond boundaries, there is no religion on earth that constitutes more than a third of the world's population. We need to learn how to live together in peace. We are all minorities. Maybe we're all Africans too. But we need to find ways to work and live together. And I hope that this conference will be a starting place for thinking hard and into the future about those issues. Thank you.
Thank Dean Quashka and Professor Durham. And we're obviously past the break, but what we would like to do is take a short break, and we'll try to capture a little bit more time over lunch. So we'll break from now until 11:25, so just 15 minutes or a little less than 15 minutes. I'm sorry, it's short. We'll begin promptly at 11:25 with the next panel.